Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowdy, with the Wall Street Journal business news for Wednesday, November 19th, 2025. And here are today's business headlines. Adobe strikes $1.9 billion deal for software provider Semrush. Semrush helps businesses from Amazon to TikTok with search engine optimization and marketing, by Lauren Thomas. Larry Summers resigns from OpenAI board amid Epstein revelations. The former Harvard University president stepped back from public comments and commitments after receiving criticism for his correspondence with sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, by Joseph D'Avila. Target to invest billions to upgrade stores as sales slumps continue. The retailer lowered its expected profit range for the full year as net sales fell 1.5% in the third quarter, by Sarah Nassauer. Paramount is the only logical winner in the three-horse race for Warner. The company has strongest motivation and resources to get the deal done, by Dan Gallagher. Elon Musk's xAI is in advanced talks to raise $15 billion, lifting valuation. Like other AI startups, the company is burning cash it seeks to improve its flagship Grok chatbot, by Becky Peterson and Berber Jin. Nexstar CEO says bigger is better in pitch to FCC. Perry Sook says broadcasters need to grow to better compete with tech companies, by Joe Flint. Our first article today is Adobe strikes $1.9 billion deal for software provider Semrush. Semrush helps businesses from Amazon to TikTok with search engine optimization and marketing, by Lauren Thomas. The deal was announced Wednesday, confirming an earlier report by the Wall Street Journal. Adobe said it will pay $12 a share in all cash for Semrush, which had a market value of a little over $1 billion as of Tuesday, after its stock closed at $6.76. Semrush went public on the New York Stock Exchange in 2021. It designs and develops software that helps companies with online advertising, social media research, and research campaigns, among other things. The deal is relatively small, a small bite for Adobe, which has a market value of over $135 billion. Adobe is best known by consumers for its software programs, including Adobe Photoshop, Adobe Illustrator, and Adobe Analytics, used for graphics design, video editing, document management, and more. Adobe stock has dropped more than 20% so far this year as investors wait to see if the company can grow into the artificial intelligence powerhouse it wants to be. Semrush shares also have been beaten down amid a broader sell-off of tech stocks. The business has touted its adoption of AI, particularly around search. It recently unveiled a new tool that helps marketers boost and measure their performance with both SEO and AI engines such as ChatGPT, Gemini, and Perplexity. Some of Semrush's big enterprise customers include TikTok and Amazon.com. The acquisition of Semrush could allow Adobe to help marketers better understand how their brands are presented to consumers online, not just through traditional search engines, but also new large language models, or LLMs. This is a natural way for us to keep growing in a space that's very important to our existing customers, said Anil Chakravarti, president of Adobe's digital experience business, in an interview with the Journal. Every chief marketing officer today is thinking about how they're showing up in ChatGPT and other platforms. Adobe, in September, raised its fiscal year outlook for the second time this year and said that its spending on AI was starting to pay off. It said customers were starting to opt into its more premium offerings so that they could have access to those new capabilities. Adobe, in 2022, tried to buy collaboration software company Figma for around $20 billion, in what would have been its biggest deal ever, but the transaction was called off over a year later after a UK regulator warned that it would likely harm innovation. Write to Lauren Thomas at lauren.thomas@wsj.com. Larry Summers resigns from OpenAI board amid Epstein revelations. Harvard's former president received criticism for his correspondence with the sex offender, by Joseph Diavia. Former Harvard University president Larry Summers has resigned from OpenAI's board after receiving criticism for previously undisclosed correspondence between him and sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Larry has decided to resign from the OpenAI board of directors, and we respect his decision, the OpenAI board said in a statement Wednesday. The board said it appreciated his contributions and the perspective he brought. I'm grateful for the opportunity to have served, excited about the potential of the company, and look forward to following their progress, Summers said in a statement. Summers is one of several high-profile people whose communications with Epstein were detailed in the more than 20,000 documents lawmakers made public last week. Being mentioned in the emails isn't an indication of wrongdoing. They nevertheless raised uncomfortable questions over his relationship with the disgraced financier. Summers said Monday he would be stepping back from public commitments as part of an effort to rebuild trust and repair relationships with the people closest to him. He said he would fulfill his teaching obligations as a Harvard professor. I'm deeply ashamed of my actions and recognize the pain that they have caused. I take full responsibility for my misguided decision to continue communicating with Mr. Epstein, Summers said on Monday. Earlier Monday, Senator Elizabeth Warren said Summers shouldn't be trusted to teach classes at the university or advise the government, saying the economist displayed monumentally bad judgment in his correspondence with Epstein. Summers became a professor of economics at Harvard in 1983, before becoming chief economist for the World Bank. He served as Treasury Secretary in the Clinton administration before being picked to lead Harvard University in 2001. Summers resigned in 2006 after the facility gave him a vote of no confidence following his delivery of a speech suggesting the paucity of women in science and engineering might be connected to a difference in the distribution of aptitude. Write to Joseph Diavila at joseph.deavila@wsj.com. Target to invest billions to upgrade stores as sales slump continues. Retailer lowers its expected profit range for a full year as net sales fell 1.5% in third quarter, by Sarah Nassauer. Target's plan to fix its continuing sales slump involves billions of dollars in investment. Incoming chief executive Michael Fidlake said the retailer would invest about $1 billion more next year to improve stores, its merchandise selection, and digital capabilities, bringing total new investment next year to $5 billion. Mission 1 through 10 is to get back to growth for us, Fidlake said on a call with reporters. Mission 1 through 10 is to get back to growth for us, Fidlake said on a call with reporters. The changes will include store experience improvements and more exciting merchandise, along with better technology and e-commerce systems, he said. Shoppers have also complained of messy stores, items missing on shelves, and less exciting products. Target's shares have fallen 35% this year. Executives said the additional spending is necessary after the retailer reported its 12th consecutive quarter last week, or falling sales for Wednesday, The company said fewer shoppers visited the stores, and those who did spent less during the quarter. Comparable sales, those from stores and digital channels operating for the last at least a year, fell 2.7% in the 3 months ended November 1st. Fidelki said consumers continued to spend cautiously on discretionary items such as home decor and apparel. He added that the most recent quarter was volatile because of several external factors, such as the pause in SNAP funding and the government shutdown. The company will share more about future expected sales after it gets through the crucial holiday shopping season, Fidelki said. Target lowered its expected profit range for the full year to between $7 and $8 a share, down from the previous range of $7 to $9, in part because of the current volatility, said Fidelki. Target's net sales fell 1.5% in the most recent quarter to $25.3 billion compared with the same period last year. Its net income fell 19% to $689 million. Last month, Target said it would cut around 1,800 corporate jobs, about 8% of its corporate employees, as part of its new strategy. Heading into the holiday season, Target said it reduced prices on 3,000 everyday products last week, such as food and household items. It also plans to offer trendy exclusives on items such as trading cards and products related to the television show Stranger Things. In addition, Target announced a shopping partnership with OpenAI that will allow users to browse Target goods through an app within ChatGPT, OpenAI's artificial intelligence platform. Users will ultimately purchase items at Target, but can search and add products to their cart with ChatGPT. Shoppers are making trade-offs over the Halloween season. Customers spent on candy and costumes, but cut back on more discretionary categories like seasonal decor, said Target's chief commercial officer, Rick Gomez. For the winter holidays, the consumer is likely to give priority to what goes under the tree versus what goes on the tree, said Gomez. That echoes signs from other retailers that some discretionary spending remains weak. On Tuesday, Home Depot reported lower third quarter profit and trimmed its full-year outlook as a downturn in home improvement activity continued. Slipping home prices, a wobbly job market, and economic uncertainty have left some customers on the sidelines, executives said. This all comes together in the form of hesitation to take on larger financial commitments, such as remodels, said Home Depot Chief Financial Officer Richard McPhail. Home Depot's comparable sales rose 0.2%, missing analysts' forecasts. Target's struggles have been a result of both external factors such as inflation, which dumped demand for the trendy throw pillows and children's clothes Target is known for, as well as self-inflicted wounds. Its shoppers have been put off by its relatively high prices compared with competitors like Walmart or online upstarts such as Temu and Shein, a dynamic that has been hard to overcome as inflation rises. In August, Target said Fidelki would become its next CEO, succeeding Brian Cornell. He will officially take on the role on February 1st. Write to Sarah Nassauer at sarah.nassauer@wsj.com. Paramount is the only logical winner in the three-horse race for Warner. The company has the strongest motivation and resources to get a deal done. By Dan Gallagher. The famed Warner Brothers studio is officially on the block, as are HBO, CNN, Turner Broadcasting, DC Comics, the Discovery Channel, and other businesses owned by Warner Brothers Discovery. Just 3.5 years old, the media conglomerate is holding an auction process with a deadline for the first round of non-bidding bids set up for Thursday. Non-binding bids set up for Thursday. Paramount Skydance, Netflix, and Comcast are all preparing offers, according to the Wall Street Journal's reporting. All three have strong reasons to pursue a deal, and conventional wisdom might give the advantage to Netflix, whose runway success as a streamer has made it the new king of Hollywood. The company's operating profit vastly exceeds what any of its rivals are generating from streaming, and its market capitalization of nearly $500 billion exceeds the combined value of its two major competitors on this deal, plus that of Disney. But Paramount Skydance is the more logical fit for Warner, and while its last reported cash position is about one-third of Netflix, the backing of the world's second richest person, Oracle founder Larry Ellison, effectively makes Paramount the deepest pocket in the game. Larry Ellison's good relationship with President Trump is also a serious competitive edge, considering the administration's fraught relationship with the media industry overall. Comcast's ownership of MSNBC, now rebranded as MS Now, would likely prove especially problematic if the companies were to seek to acquire the owner of CNN. Warner's deep well of established intellectual property is a draw for all bidders. Warner runs one of the largest TV production studios in Hollywood, and the Harry Potter series is but one of four Warner film franchises that have grossed more than $5 billion globally, according to the industry tracking site The Numbers. Those franchises alone would be a big boost to Paramount, which has trailed Warner, Disney, and Universal in annual box office share during most of the past decade. More important, combining Paramount's and Warner's respective streaming offerings would bring the industry some necessary consolidation, while also creating a platform with the heft necessary to better compete with the industry's leaders. If you put Paramount and Warner together, you don't quite get Disney scale. But it's close enough to that, Bernstein analyst Laurent Yoon said in an interview. The complication of pairing that IP with Netflix is that the company has long avoided the theatrical business in favor of giving priority to its streaming subscribers. Even blockbuster success hasn't seemed to shift that thinking. Our strategy is to give our members exclusive first-run movies on Netflix, Netflix co-chief executive Ted Sarandos said on a company's earnings call last month, responding to a question about the success of K-pop Demon Hunters, which Netflix put on movie screens for one weekend in October and still grossed about $18 million domestically, even though the movie had already been on its streaming platform for 2 months. In streaming, Warner's 128 million global subscribers wouldn't actually do much for Netflix, which now has about 317 million subscribers, according to analysts' consensus estimates from Visible Alpha. Yoon notes that about 94% of subscribers to Warner's HBO Max service are also Netflix subscribers, while that overlap is only about 51% for HBO Max and Paramount. Netflix has also long eschewed major M&A moves. Its largest deal to date was valued around $680 million, according to FactSet. So spending what would likely be north of $60 billion would be a heavy lift. It's also unclear what Netflix would want with Warner's shrinking cable TV channels and other vestiges of legacy media. The financial burden of such transaction could significantly weaken Netflix's balance sheet and dilute shareholders, Robert Fishman of Moffitt Nathanson wrote in a note to clients last week. He said he believes that Netflix is merely doing its due diligence on Warner by kicking the tires and would not pay a premium to the current price in a competitive bidding process. Paramount has already been hard at the effort. Warner has rebuffed three offers so far from the company, with the last one offering a price Warner's stock hasn't seen since April of 2022, right after it completed its merger with the Discovery Inc. Warner is also trying to separate its streaming and studio business from its cable TV side, and that split would make a deal far more palatable for Netflix and Comcast, who only want the former. But Warner and its chief executive, David Zaslav, might be hard-pressed to keep turning away David Ellison, CEO of Paramount. David Ellison has big ambitions for the storied studio, but needs a scale to compete effectively against powerful streamers such as Netflix and Disney, as well as the deep pockets of Apple and Amazon.com. M&A hopes are also the only thing that has made Warner stock into anything resembling a hit. The shares have surged 89% since mid-September, when the Journal reported that Paramount was preparing a bid for the company. Even then, shares have badly lagged behind the overall market since the Discovery merger. For Warner, a deal with Paramount might be the only real show in town. Write to Dan Gallagher at dan.gallagher@wsj.com. Elon Musk's xAI is in advanced talks to raise $15 billion, lifting valuation. Like other AI startups, company is burning cash rapidly as it seeks to improve its flagship Grok chatbot by Becky Peterson and Berber Jin. Elon Musk's artificial intelligence company, xAI, is in advanced talks to raise $15 billion in new equity at a $230 billion valuation, according to people familiar with the plans. The new valuation would represent a significant increase from the $113 billion xAI disclosed after acquiring Musk's social media site X in March. The terms of the new fundraising were disclosed to investors by Musk's wealth manager, Jared Burchill, on Tuesday night, the People said. It couldn't be determined whether the expected new valuation Burchill shared with investors reflected its worth before or after the new investment is received. Burchill and spokeswoman for xAI didn't immediately respond to requests for comment. CNBC earlier reported xAI's planned fundraising. After the article was published, Musk wrote false in response to an X post about the article from a fellow user of his social media platform. Many AI startups, including xAI, are burning cash rapidly as they seek to build infrastructure to help train and refine models. The companies are laying the groundwork for trillions of dollars in spending in the coming years, leaving them in a near constant state of fundraising. In June, xAI raised $5 billion in equity and $5 billion in debt to help build out its Colossus data center in Memphis, Tennessee. Musk's rocket company, SpaceX, invested $2 billion in the company as part of that round, the Wall Street Journal previously reported. Musk, who is chief executive officer of Tesla, has publicly supported the idea of Tesla investing in xAI. In a recent shareholder meeting, Tesla shareholders had a mixed response to a proposal that asked the board to take such an investment, and is now up to the board to decide. Ahead of the meeting, Tesla chair Robin Denholm told the Journal that she questioned the logic of such an investment and said the board hadn't yet done any of the due diligence required to move forward. Musk's AI startup has raised billions of dollars in its race to compete with OpenAI and to expand the capabilities of its chatbot, Grok, which competes with chatbot GPT. News Corp, owner of the Journal, has content licensing partnership with OpenAI. Musk's turned his attention to xAI after wrapping up his work with the federal government, the Journal reported. The startup has recently lost several senior executives, including ex-CEO Linda Yaccarino, as well as the chief finance officers of X and xAI. write to Becky Peterson at becky.peterson@wsj.com and Berber Jin at Berber, that's B-E-R-B-E-R dot J-I-N at wsj.com. Nexstar CEO says bigger is better in pitch to FCC. Perry Sook says broadcasters need to grow to better compete with tech companies, by Joe Flint. Nexstar Media Group has more than 200 television stations across the country from New York City to Rapid City, South Dakota. But when Chief Executive Perry Sook makes his argument for government approval of Nexstar's $6.2 billion deal to acquire rival broadcaster Tegna, he plans to focus on his company's scale relative to tech companies rather than other traditional broadcasters. A broadcasting giant is probably an oxymoron in today's environment compared to big tech that can reach every screen on every device in every home in every car in any suit coat pocket in America, Sook said in an interview. So that's really who we compete against. Already the nation's biggest broadcaster, Nexstar is the limit for how many television stations it can control. The Federal Communications Commission's current television station ownership rules limit any one company's reach to 39% of the nation's television homes. Combined with Tegna, which owns 64 stations, Nexstar would reach 60%. The FCC would need to waive its rules or change them to accommodate the Texas-based broadcaster's proposed Tegna deal. Limits on television ownership, designed in large part to ensure competition and diversity of views, have been relaxed many times over the past several decades. Nexstar filed its application Tuesday at the FCC to take over the Tegna stations. The acquisition also faces an antitrust review from the Justice Department, which last month sent a second letter requesting more information about the deal. Nexstar isn't the only television station owner trying to get bigger. Sinclair, which owns or operates 178 stations this week, disclosed a roughly 8% stake in rival broadcaster EW Scripps, with the goal of acquiring the entire company. The two companies held constructive talks about a potential deal in recent months, Sinclair said. Scripps said in a statement that its board will take all steps appropriate to protect the company and the company's shareholders from the opportunistic actions of Sinclair or anyone else. Local television, Sook warned, is in danger of following the path of the newspaper industry of if broadcast television is still regulated as if it is a world dominated by ABC, CBS, and NBC, instead of one that competes with Google, Amazon.com, Netflix, and TikTok. Will be able to outspend big tech ever? Probably not, Sook said, but I definitely can't even compete at the company's current size. Sook became part of a controversy in September when Nexstar told Disney's ABC it would stop carrying the late-night show Jimmy Kimmel Live on more than two dozen of its stations after the comedian criticized how President Trump and others reacted to the killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. Disney temporarily suspended the show. Sook, whom associates described as politically conservative, said Nexstar wasn't against political humor. However, he said he felt Kimmel's remarks about the Kirk killing were insensitive and inaccurate. Critics of the decision said it would have a chilling effect on free speech. That's not a First Amendment issue, Sook said. The First Amendment is a compact between you and the government, not you and a private employee. Sook said Nexstar had respectful conversations with ABC. We felt that our point had been made and that it was time to move on. Media watchdogs are worried about Nexstar getting bigger and the pressure it could put on local advertising and journalism. Because Nexstar typically controls several stations in the same market, there are fears of the power it could wield over advertisers. In 2018, the Justice Department accused it of sharing sales forecasting information with competing broadcasters. Nexstar settled with the Justice Department without admitting wrongdoing. There are real serious competitive concerns, said Andrew Schweitzerman, a veteran public interest advocate who opposed Tegna's proposed merger with Standard General in 2023, which never closed. There are also worries that diversity of local news coverage will be harmed if Nexstar gets control of more local stations and consolidates operations. Sook said that getting bigger doesn't mean the news product gets worse. He said Nexstar increased the volume of local news coverage after it acquired Tribune and Media General. Our news looks different in Tampa than it does in San Diego, and looks different in Burlington, Vermont than it does in Champaign, Illinois, Sook said, and it's probably because the only way those products are commercially successful, even commercially viable, is if they serve the needs of the local communities. Being a formidable competitor against the tech companies isn't Sook's only motivation. Nexstar and many other local broadcasters have found themselves chafing with their broadcast network partners over issues including how much they pay for the programming. The bigger Nexstar can get, the more leverage it will have in its dealings with ABC, NBC, and CBS. It could also compete for major sports rights. Could I make a bid for NFL rights? Sook wondered aloud. Not if he continues to be kept artificially small, he said. Nexstar also owns a smaller CW network and has given priority to college sports for that service. Sook expressed confidence that Tegna deal would get through the FCC review. FCC Chairman Brendan Carr has already indicated support for deregulation of TV ownership rules. Getting the deal cleared by the Justice Department might be a harder task. Speaking to analysts on the company's quarterly earnings call earlier this month, Sook said, "There's a lot of work ahead of us in complying with the DOJ request." Write to Joe Flint at joe.flint@wsj.com. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take Sun Sounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. Canada says Anglo-Americans' pledges to secure tech resources deal not enough. Canada's industry minister aims to deliver a decision next month on whether Anglo-American can proceed with its takeover of tech resources by Paul Vieira and Rob M. Stewart. Ottawa. Canada's Canadian industry minister Melanie Joly is aiming to deliver a decision next month on whether Anglo-American can proceed with its takeover of tech resources, but warned that the British miners' pledges to date aren't enough. Under a revised Canadian industrial strategy, the government wants to maintain homegrown global companies with big Canadian headquarters, Joly said. What I've said is that what Anglo-Tech was offering was not enough, and I think that Canadians should get more out of this merger of equals, and the process is continuing, she said. A spokesman for Tech said the companies continue to engage with the government about what is opportunity to strengthen the company's critical minerals sector. This merger of equals will create a Canadian-based global critical minerals champion with significant economic, social, and strategic benefits for Canada, he said. A spokesman for Anglo declined to comment and said the company wouldn't offer running commentary on discussions with the government regarding the deal. As industry minister, Joly is responsible for enforcing Canada's foreign investment laws, which require government approval for foreign-led mergers and acquisitions to ensure they are in the national interest. Anglo and Teck in September reached a deal to create one of the world's largest copper producers with a combined market value of more than $53 billion. Anglo has estimated the transaction values Teck at more than $17 billion and projected the merger would close within 18 months. The deal, one of the biggest ever in the mining industry, proposes the creation of a company named Anglo Teck that would be based in Vancouver, British Columbia, with Anglo Chief Executive Duncan Wanblad leading the merged company and Teck CEO Jonathan Price becoming Deputy Chief Executive. Anglo shareholders are set to own about 62% of the combined business, with Teck shareholders owning just under 38%. The tie-up would create a copper producer with annual output of some 1.2 million metric tons and key assets in Chile, Peru, and Canada. It comes as demand for metal is rising amid a shift to greener sources of energy, with a growing need for a key component of electric cars and AI data centers. Canada last year approved the sale of Teck's coal assets to Glencore, although at the same time cautioned that pending approval of foreign led deals involving critical minerals, including copper, would only be granted in the most exceptional of circumstances. Jolly said the vision for Canada's industries is to create national champions and more homegrown companies in Canada. In addition to assets in Peru, Chile, and the U.S., Teck operates the Highlight Valley Copper and Molybdenum mining operation in south-central British Columbia. The company has plans to extend the life of the Canadian operation to 2046 from 2028, which it estimated would create about 2,900 jobs during construction and generate hundreds of millions of dollars in annual gross domestic product. Write to Paul Vieira at paul.vieira@wsj.com and Rob M. Stewart at robstewart@wsj.com. Lowe's sales rise, boosted by growth in pro-builder business. Third quarter sales rose to $20.81 billion, up from $20.17 billion the year before, by Nicholas G. Miller. Lowe's reported higher third quarter sales as continued growth in its business supplying professional builders helped it to offset weakness in the home improvement market. The home improvement retailer reported net income of $1.62 billion, or $2.88 a share, down from $1.7 billion, or $2.99 a share, the year prior. The company incurred $129 million in pre-tax expenses associated with recent acquisitions. Adjusted earnings were $3.06 a share. Analysts had expected a $2.97 a share, according to FactSet. Sales rose to $20.81 billion, up from $20.17 billion the year before. Wall Street had expected $20.82 billion. Comparable sales rose 0.4%, driven by 11% online sales growth, double-digit growth in home services, and continued growth in its professional builder supply business. Analysts had expected 1% comparable sales growth. The company raised its full-year sales outlook to $86 billion, up from its previous forecast of $84.5 billion to $85.5 billion. It guided for flat comparable sales relative to the prior year, compared with its previous guidance of flat to 1% growth. It also forecast full-year adjusted earnings of $12.25 a share, compared with its previous guidance of $12.20 a share to $12.45 a share. Analysts see full-year sales of $85.31 billion, compared comparable sales growth of 0.3% and adjusted earnings of $12.28 a share. Home improvement activity has sagged as a stagnant housing market, high interest rates, and general uncertainty about the economic environment led homeowners to delay remodeling and repair projects. On Tuesday, Home Depot trimmed its full-year outlook and said that an expected uptick in home improvement demand had failed to materialize. Home improvement retailers have said that an aging housing stock and surging home equity values will eventually lead to a turnaround in home improvement demand. But so far, the market has shown few signs of picking up, even as interest rates have crept lower. According to Placer.ai, foot traffic at Lowe's in the third quarter slipped 0.1% from the previous year. But Home Depot and Lowe's have both expanded their businesses, supplying professional builders. Last month, Lowe's completed its $8.8 billion acquisition of Foundation Building Materials, marking a significant leap into the professional builder market following large acquisitions by Home Depot. The two companies are competing for the more consistent spending of professional building and repair companies, particularly as consumers delay large remodels and do-it-yourself projects, analysts say. Write to Nicholas G. Miller at nicholas.miller@wsj.com. The weight loss craze is about to mint a trillion-dollar company. Eli Lilly shares have room to keep rising as GLP-1 drugs spread reach, by David Wainer. The trillion-dollar club has become crowded, with mostly tech names riding the AI boom. Eli Lilly might soon join them for a far different reason, the weight loss bonanza. Crucially, Lilly's trajectory doesn't hinge on artificial intelligence sentiment or cloud spending cycles that investors are suddenly questioning. In fact, it could even benefit from an investor rotation away from technology into other sectors. Its staying power of above $1 trillion market value will come down to two questions: how quickly it can expand the obesity drug market and how completely it can dominate it. In both fronts, its future looks promising. This year, Lilly has moved sharply ahead, securing Medicare access while widening its deal over Wegovy maker Novo Nordisk. That is why investors shouldn't assume the rally stops at a trillion. The key thing to remember is that, much like the AI boom, the GLP-1 surge is still in its infancy. Lilly only began selling its weight loss drug Zepbound in late 2023, and the Food and Drug Administration only declared an end to a supply shortage of obesity drugs last year. As the production has scaled up and new clinical data has emerged, Zepbound has pulled ahead of Wegovy. Despite Zepbound's later launch, Lilly now captures a clear majority of new obesity drug prescriptions, a sharp shift in market dynamics. The shift shows up clearly in market valuations. In the end of March 2024, Novo Nordisk was worth over $500 billion and Lilly more than $700 billion. Since then, the gap has widened. Lilly has surged to about $970 billion, while Novo Nordisk has fallen to around $200 billion. Under a recent deal with the Trump administration, the GLP makers agreed to lower prices in exchange for broader Medicare and potential Medicaid coverage, an arrangement Lilly says could expand access to its obesity drugs to roughly 40 million additional patients. That comes at a pivotal moment. Lilly and Novo Nordisk have finally worked through the supply bottlenecks that once capped growth, and they're now preparing to launch pills for weight loss. Those oral drugs will enter a market that is far more mature, explains Trevor Davis, a healthcare strategist with Citi. When the trajectories debuted, adoption was held back by shortages and uneven insurance coverage. Lilly's pill, by contrast, is easier to manufacture at scale and will launch into a market that is now structurally ready to take it up. It will also be cheaper. What is more, Lilly appears to be only at the beginning of a large international expansion. In the third quarter, Mounjaro's revenue outside the U.S. jumped to $2.97 billion from $728 million a year earlier. The company says roughly 75% of these sales were from people with obesity paying for the drug in cash. As markets such as Brazil and Europe open up and reimbursement improves, investors could realize that the global opportunity for GLP-1s might be the real sleeping giant in Lilly's story. If Lilly soon crosses the $1 trillion mark, debates over valuation will intensify. The stock trades at roughly 34 times forward earnings, not outrageous for a company growing this quickly, but richer than NVIDIA or Microsoft, both closer to 30, and far above the pharma average of about 16. But analysts are steadily revising earnings forecast upwards, a trend that could narrow that premium. Lilly's twin brands, Mounjaro and Zepbound, are expected to generate over $40 billion in annual sales by 2026, rising towards $60 billion by the end of the decade, according to FactSet. That would make tirzepatide, the shared ingredient behind both drugs, the best-selling medicine in history. By then, Lilly could start to feel the impact from emerging competitors such as Amgen and Pfizer, which recently acquired obesity biotech Metsera. But the biggest risk to its ability to stay in the trillion-dollar club over the long term is the patient system. Unlike Apple or NVIDIA, which in theory can iterate their products indefinitely, drug makers face a regulatory law of physics. Every blockbuster eventually goes off patent. The result is a built-in cyclicity that even the strongest pipelines can't escape. As Cities Davis puts it, this will be the biggest patent cliff of all time. Lilly has lived through the cycle before, when patents expired on blockbusters such as depression drug Cymbalta, revenue sagged. It wasn't until 2020 that Lilly's revenue returned to its 2011 level. That history explains why Lilly is now buying technologies aimed far into the future, including moonshot bets such as Verve Therapeutics' gene editing platform. Those are critical questions, but ones that won't be settled until well into the next decade. For now, Lilly's growth engine has plenty of room to keep growing. Write to David Wehner at david.wehner@wsj.com. Roche shares rise after breast cancer pill shows positive results in trial. Shares were up 6.1% in European morning trading by Maitain Sardin. Roche shares rose after the Swiss pharmaceutical company said an experimental pill for breast cancer showed positive results in a large late-stage trial. The drug maker said Tuesday that the trial results for the drug, Gerdenstrat, opened the door to adding a treatment option for an early stage of the disease when most patients are diagnosed. Shares in Roche were up 6.1% in European morning trading, bringing the stock's year-to-date gain to 19%. Gerdenstrat showed statistically significant and clinically meaningful benefit compared with standard endocrine therapy in late-stage study that included more than 4,100 patients, Roche said. The pill is an oral selective estrogen receptor designed to fight tumors driven by the hormone estrogen, which are estimated to account for up to 70% of all breast cancer cases. Overall survival data were immature, but showed a positive trend with no unexpected safety findings observed, Roche said. This was the second large-scale clinical trial for Gerdenstrat to achieve a positive outcome following results from another study with patients who had advanced breast cancer presented at an oncology congress in October. The company said that there were 5 late-stage trials underway for the drug that span multiple treatment settings and lines of therapy. Roche said it would share the results with health authorities with the aim of bringing a new potential treatment option to markets around the world. Tuesday's results underscore the potential of giredestrant as a new endocrine therapy of choice for people with early stage breast cancer, where there is a chance for cure, said Roche's chief medical officer, Levi Garraway. The stronger than expected results from the trial are a positive surprise, JP Morgan analyst said in a research note. Roche has the potential to capture around $5 billion in potential sales, even considering competition from AstraZeneca's rival treatment candidate, camizestrant, they added. Write to Maitane Sardon at maitane.sardon@dowjones.com. And here's an opinion article. China's Myanmar project could end U.S. sanctions. The digital currency would operate outside SWIFT, but still have access to American banks. By Dan Swift and Sean Turnell. A quiet financial experiment in Myanmar could upend the power of U.S. sanctions worldwide. Documents have recently reviewed show China is helping Myanmar's military junta build a digital payment system that can move money beyond Washington's reach, an apparent test run for how Beijing's financial technology can shield rogue regimes from U.S. pressure. The project's backbone is China's digital yuan, or ECNY. Beijing's current bank issues this electronic money via authorized banks, and users access it via apps. Unlike private payment systems like PayPal or Alipay, a central bank digital currency allows the issuer to see every transaction in real time and even decide how that money can be spent. In Myanmar, the documents show that Chinese engineers are adapting this model to create an electronic kyat, Myanmar's national currency, using infrastructure from Huawei and the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, the world's largest bank. Huawei, ICBC, and the Central Bank of Myanmar didn't respond to requests for comment. On paper, it could look like a modernization project meant to reduce the costs of printing and storing currency. In practice, it's a potential blueprint for sanctions evasion. Most international transfers move through SWIFT, the global messaging system monitored by the U.S. Treasury. When Washington imposes sanctions on a company, those payments stop. China's alternative, the Cross-Border Interbank Payment System, or CIPS, bypasses SWIFT and U.S. oversight entirely. Myanmar's junta already uses CIPS for some trade with China, but the country's chaotic cash-based economy makes system evasion difficult at scale. It's too difficult to move as much cash as large-scale sanctions evasion would necessitate. A digital kyat removes that bottleneck by creating a seamless payment infrastructure, and Myanmar's digital kyat pilot program, which the government announced in general terms in June. The Central Bank of Myanmar would issue digital kyat via authorized banks. Any of these that trade with China would go to ICBC, which would convert digital kyat into digital yuan, and transactions would route through CIPS instead of dollar channels. The system could let entities subject to sanctions move funds without touching SWIFT. More important, the layered structure of Myanmar's central bank to people and businesses to ICBC to CHIPS would obscure who controls the money. ICBC has correspondent relationships with nearly all American largest banks, potentially opening a backdoor to the U.S. financial system. Military companies under sanction could get access to dollar clearing via shell companies or Chinese intermediaries, making ownership nearly impossible to trace. Each conversion point adds another layer of anonymity. Washington should treat this as a direct challenge to the international financial system. Just because Beijing is beginning in Myanmar doesn't mean it'll stop there. Expanding this sort of digital currency system to other regimes could allow China to chip away at U.S. financial dominance by creating a parallel system immune to Western sanctions. Commercially, the ICBC could earn fees. The documents show it will, in the case of Myanmar, and become the banker for regimes or entities blocked out of Western finance.
The two goals reinforce each other. China weakens U.S. leverage while profiting from isolation. Myanmar is an ideal testing ground. It's a cash-starved state, blacklisted by the Group of Seven's Financial Action Task Force, and awash in narcotics and money from online fraud. For Beijing, Myanmar is low profile enough to experiment on. Compared with fellow FATF, blacklisted states, North Korea and Iran, yet strategically vital for China's access to the Indian Ocean. For Myanmar's junta, it's a lifeline to move money when the dollar doors are closed. The Treasury Department should warn U.S. banks to sever correspondent relationships with ICBC and other institutions facilitating CIPS-based payments. ICBC's correspondent ties with major American banks provide dollar access, creating a potential backdoor to evade sanctions and reach U.S. markets through Chinese intermediaries. Washington shouldn't allow ICBC to maintain privileged access to American finance while building infrastructure to evade American sanctions. This digital kyat system is a losing proposition for the people of Myanmar, particularly the pro-democracy movement. By embedding Chinese technology in Myanmar's payment system, Beijing gains visibility into every transaction and leverage over the entire country. In exchange for short-term survival, Myanmar's junta is trading away monetary sovereignty to an unpopular foreign power. If the system works, China's control may prove irreversible even if democracy returns to Myanmar. If it fails, Myanmar faces economic ruin reminiscent of 1987, when dictator Ne Win avoided all banknotes in denominations divisible by his lucky number 9, wiping out citizens' savings overnight. People were left with little money even for food. Chinese digital currency pilot in Myanmar is far from a local story. Beijing is laying the first pipe for financial plumbing in a post-American world, where U.S. sanctions no longer matter. If Washington doesn't act, expect China's construction project to extend to every hostile regime around the world. Mr. Swift is a senior research analyst at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy Center on Economic and Financial Power and a retired U.S. diplomat who served in Myanmar 2015 to 2019. Mr. Turnell is a senior fellow at the Lowy Institute. He served as an economic policy advisor to State Councilor Aung San Suu Kyi in Myanmar and was a political prisoner there in 2021 to 2022. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.